We cannot think religious liberty outside of the enslavement of Africans. We cannot think religious liberty outside of the genocide of Native Americans. We cannot think religious liberty in the United States in an area, in a nation that some consider a crime.
We had a lively interest in whatever the administration was doing with respect to church and state.
This is something that we fought hard for.
Religious liberty is one of the hallmarks and part of the bedrock of American democracy.
We at the BJC like to say when anyone's religious liberty is threatened, everyone's religious liberty is at risk.
Welcome to the BJC podcast. I'm Holly Holman, the General Counsel of the Baptist Joint Committee. Today we're bringing you a special conversation we hosted on an inclusive approach to religious liberty today. At the BJC dinner on April 26, Dr. Corey Walker and Dr. Linda McKinnish Bridges took the stage with BJC's Amanda Tyler for a frank and honest discussion about what gets left out of our conversations. Corey Walker is a professor at the University of Richmond, and Linda McKinnish Bridges is the president of the Baptist Theological Seminary at Richmond. You'll hear them discuss ways they have worked together in attempts to bridge these gaps. After that discussion, we'll bring you another part of the dinner program, testimonials from several of our BJC fellows. The fellows are a group of young professionals who have gone through our education and training program at Colonial Williamsburg. But for the first 35 minutes of the podcast, take a listen to this conversation with Corey Walker, Linda McKinnish Bridges, and Amanda Tyler.
All right. Well, as we get to our conversation for the evening, I'm so pleased to welcome up here Dr. Corey Walker and Dr. Linda McKinnish Bridges, two accomplished scholars and leaders who have also become my friends. So thank you for joining us tonight. Their resumes are impressive and extensive, and they are in your programs. And so in the interest of time, I'm going to refer you there to learn more about them. But I want to get right into the reason of our gathering tonight, and that's to talk about religious liberty, and specifically to talk about how we can have an inclusive conversation about religious liberty. We live, though, in confused times, as we've talked about, and even the words religious liberty don't always have clear meaning anymore. So I want to clear up any confusion right off the bat, and I'm going to ask you both, how do you define religious liberty? What do you mean by those words?
In a very simple statement, religious liberty to me means the freedom to give expression to my religious consciousness or not.
That's good, Linda.
Thank you. But you can do better. Do it.
Religious liberty is not only the freedom to exercise any sort of religious belief, practice, understanding, ritual, or not, but it is also the ability to be able to do that in a manner that is unobstructed by the legitimate powers of the state and unobstructed by fellow citizens who may disagree with that particular practice. So it has to be robust and not only expounding the freedom of the practice and the idea, but it also has to set some of the conditions for the exercise of it. And that's where in the U.S. history, our United States history of religious freedom, we have so many problems. Problems both at the conceptual level as well as at the experiential level. Mm-hmm. And we see that just this year in the cases that you highlight. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, to start our conversation, I actually want to refer to some images that are in your program that came from a presentation that Corey made at a course on religious liberty and religious dissent for the Baptist Theological Seminary Richmond last summer. On the left, you'll see an image of a plaque on the Richmond Slave Trail, and on the right, a stencil on the sidewalk marking the Richmond Liberty Trail. And here we are having this conversation in the midst of the Alliance of Baptists gathering with the theme, What is Liberty Without Liberation? So a conversation about these two trails makes a lot of sense here. And Corey, I wondered if you could speak to these images and how this came up in the course last summer.
Well, last summer, Baptist Theological Seminary of Richmond had an opportunity to create a class on religious liberty with some very generous funding from the Cassie Foundation. And our partners at BTSR brought in a number of folks from throughout the Baptist world. And Bill Leonard and I, Amanda, you contributed to that course. I know Sabrina contributed to that course, Charles. There were so many who contributed to this course on Baptist liberty that began in Richmond and ended in Washington, D.C. And it was not only a class that moved around Virginia, but it began with an idea of the unique Baptist heritage of religious freedom. And what we began to do, instead of creating a hagiography or hagiographic portrait around Baptists, this heroic narrative that Baptists gave us this unique vision of religious liberty, and we've been holding the banner and the torch aloft for all of these years, we just looked at the ground. We began to look at the reality. And in Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, where we have the Richmond Liberty Trail, we also have the Richmond Slave Trail. We cannot think religious liberty outside of the enslavement of Africans. We cannot think religious liberty outside of the genocide of Native Americans. We cannot think religious liberty in the United States in an area, in a nation that some consider a crime scene. So we put these two images together, and we began to think a new narrative of religious liberty, a new narrative of how to think that although we can all call and claim the concept of religious liberty, how is it that it means so many different things to so many different people, and we can actually deny liberty to those who we want to seek as our fellow citizens and who begin to challenge the very boundaries of religious liberty?
And Linda, you designed this course under your leadership and brought all these people together. What did this teaching do to change the trajectory of the course?
So the Cassie Foundation helped us fund this, as well as Richmond's First Baptist Church and River Road Church Baptist. So we had a good group of supporters that were making this happen. And in the beginning of our planning, it really was, as one of the early students, as they signed up, said, I'm ready to make Baptists great again. Meaning, I want to hear some good news about this denomination. So let me come into this course and as you've said, extol the visions of these early Baptists. Of course, Bill Leonard was in some of those early conversations, and we began to add the subtitle, Voices of Dissent. And it seemed culturally appropriate from that angle to begin thinking about dissent, our heritage, our right as this denomination has existed to be. But then Leonard, and if you know Bill Leonard, said, there's not enough voices in this. we got to get Corey in on this. And Corey and I had developed a friendship in Winston-Salem, where he was dean of the School of Winston-Salem State, Winston-Salem University, and was the dean of the art science, the arts and science school there, in education and multiple other departments within that school. And we said, we're coming to Richmond. I was coming to the Baptist Theological Seminary. He was coming to the Samuel DeWitt Proctor School of Theology. And so let's do something together. Let's walk into the capital of that Confederacy together and do something together. So Bill said, we must get Corey's voice in. So that was, yes, yes, we must. We got Corey's voice in, and then the narrative changed. The texture got complex. It wasn't just making Baptists great again, but the interesting thing about it, because the interesting piece to the course was it was also an experiential piece. We were having lectures, of course, and we were having readings and presentations, but we were also walking on the stones. And so as we sat together at Lumpkin City Jail, many of those students were so very uncomfortable, they wanted to leave the course. But as you and I know, those are the ones that need to stay in the course. And at the moment, we began speaking in the ways that Dr. Corey Walker can help us see, then we realized, Leonard and I both, that we had the same course, but yet different. And it was not enough just to extol the virtues of our Baptist forebears, but it was trying to really understand what it was to live together, and it was our work. And it was important for us to talk about these things together. And it was an important thing because Baptist Theological Seminary needed to speak about these matters. We were in Richmond for that very reason back when the Alliance of Baptists began us in 1989, because we were in a community that was in close proximity to Samuel DeWitt Proctor School of Theology and also to Union Presbyterian Seminary and Tim Tutt. We could be born in a place with ecumenical diversity and then also racial inclusion. And it was a part of our birthright, but it wasn't very clear. This course made it clear.
So we're here tonight with a group that's ready to be troubled, right? And the way that this course troubled the students and everyone present. So what do we do about this? What do we do about honoring the contributions of people like Leland, who helped influence the writing of the First Amendment, helped influence the 1786 Act for Religious Freedom, without ignoring the fact that the authors of that legislation were themselves slave owners, that while not ignoring the fact that Baptist ministers at that time, some of them were slave owners? What do we do with this? How do we hold this contradiction?
The important image, or one of the many images, and Corey, I hope you'll give some of the insights that you gave us those days that we were together in the course, but one of the images were the variations of religious expression that came across on those ships. And it was important for us to think that these were people with faith consciousness and with religious consciousness. So when I say the freedom to express your religious consciousness or not, here were groups of people that had a religious consciousness, but in order to be subversive or submissive, rather, to their master, they had to absorb a Christian position. They were beaten into submission to be Christian. So we saw the balconies where those lived and sat and had become Christian because they were forced to assume the religion of their master. That insight, yeah, we read it in a book, yeah. But going into those places and sitting in those chairs. Now, this was our work. This wasn't Corey's work. This was white people's work. And we were blessed to have someone who could help us see, but that's not his burden. Sorry, Corey. That's my burden. And it was important to stand in the stones and to sit in the pews and see how religious liberty had been coerced, and how could we talk about religious liberty with those Baptist forebears unless we talked about what they were doing.
We began, one way in which we can figure out a way to host this is not as simply there's a contradiction to religious liberty or to religious freedom at the moment of inception. It is not a contradiction. Leland's notion of religious liberty was for the humans that Leland understood were human. 50 years later, the same John Leland will then have no problem with slavery. The reason I can connect John Leland from the late 18th century to the early 19th century is there's one consistency. He understood a notion of what it meant to be human, and that was consistent. When we begin to think that we can have founders, Baptists, who understand what it means to be, understand religious freedom in a particular way, in a particular language, and then be consistent. We were sitting in St. John's Episcopal Church, and we heard the reenactment of Patrick Henry's "Give me liberty or give me death." At the same time, he was holding over 80 enslaved Africans right across the James River. He understood what it meant to be human. And in many ways, that image of what it means to be human is then reflected back to the very image of God. The task right now is to desegregate God. Amen. We have to go deeper to the very idea of the Creator that we've created in our own limited image. That then gives birth to one singular mode of what it means to be human in the world. So we can't talk about Baptist liberty and inclusion, because I don't want to be included in the creation of that limited God who then limits humanity to only one way. That's why we have this idea of religious liberty that's now being tethered to a new expression of American nationalism. America, as this Christian nation, is inextricably linked with the exercise of white supremacy. This means that what we have to do as Baptists is not go back and regain or begin to think of this history of make Baptists great again. No. We have to be authentic and true to the gospel of Jesus as Baptists in the world today. How do we do that? We do that by operationalizing a desegregated theology. A theology that is inclusive of all of God's creation. And that inclusive aspect means that we have to revise the narrative. We have to tell a new story. We have to sing new songs. We have to begin to imagine a whole new world. A whole new world for a whole new human that is being birthed in this moment. It's not something that's difficult. It's not something that's very easy. It is very difficult because it's going to go to the very roots of what we believe. That's the radical nature of this proposition. That's the radical nature of religious liberty. It means having the capacity, having the disposition, cultivating the virtue to begin to host that which is other in all of its otherness. not assimilating it to the same. If we can do that, then it's quite possible that we can give birth to a new expression, a much more robust expression, not only of religious liberty, but also of human community, beyond a nationalism. Shall we say, a beloved community?
To give an example of what Corey is saying in this course, we're troubled, and Corey is talking to us, and students are beginning to ask, because they are, as good students do, you know, let's see if we can get some more information here. And I forget exactly the exact question, but it was something like, how could that happen? Mm-hmm. You know, how did that happen? And Corey, it was one of those epiphany moments that happens, those folks are teachers and students, and you know, in that classroom, when something just gels. And Corey says, you had to see those enslaved souls as non-human animals. And then you could create a hermeneutic that worked for you. You could create a theology that worked for you. And at that moment, it was like, okay, we, as I've said before, we've got to rewire the house. And I'm sorry, the electricity's still on, but we have to rewire the house, and it's going to burn. It's going to sting, and it's going to hurt. And we're going to be very red and uncomfortable. But it's important for us to do. It is our work now.
And Corey, you've been leading us in this work. And I, you know, in addition to this conversation, you helped lead a project along with BJC fellow Dr. Sabrina Dent at our partner, the museum's Religious Freedom Center, for this course in race, religious freedom, and the politics of belonging, for students from historically Black theological seminaries to come and study last January. BJC was a proud partner with you, and Charles and Sabrina taught a class at our offices as part of this course. But I thought our friends here tonight might be interested in learning more about what inspired that and what you learned from that, and what are the plans for the future of that course?
Well, what we did was we received a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation at the Samuel DeWitt Proctor School of Theology. And the grant was for a project on religious freedom that was designed in such a manner that really didn't get at the core of what we were seeking to accomplish. So at Virginia Union, we convened two design sessions. And I took our partners from the Center for Religious Freedom, came down, and then we held another design session in Washington and brought in some more conversational partners. And through these two design sessions, what we came out with was a way of attempting to disrupt the narrative around religious freedom. And disrupting that narrative is simply not only rethinking the history and the historiography of religious freedom, but also beginning to look at what resources do we need to cultivate and who do we need to curate around tables to begin this conversation that then opens up to new possibilities. We then opened up this project with a public conversation. And we were intentional in opening up the project with a public conversation because conversations are risk-filled endeavors. Mm-hmm. To engage in a conversation means you're putting yourself at risk for transformation. Too often we don't want conversations. In many ways, our preachings and sermons are not conversations. They're not dialogues in the real true sense. They're monologues. So no one gets changed. It's one directional. We wanted to create this radically democratic space to begin to imagine new possibilities. So we brought our dear friend Yolanda Pierce, who's dean at Howard University School of Divinity. We brought Brad Braxton from the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And we had myself and who else did we have that night? And Ambassador Susan Johnson, who was the third ambassador for religious freedom under President Obama, for a public conversation on how do we begin to think about this. We didn't have a plan. We didn't have any points. Instead, we wanted the conversation to be organic and to open up new possibilities for ways in which we can begin to explore this concept of religious freedom. We followed up that conversation with a class of almost 40 students from the 6 historically black theological institutions across the nation for a one-week intensive in January. And as a result of that class, what we realized was we need to actually go deeper. We need folks to understand that the question of religious liberty in our particular moment, the reason why it's so protean and the ways in which people can attach different meanings to it is not only because of the very plastic nature of it, but because of the very national and political context in which it emerges. We exalt religious freedom as part of a nationalistic project. And that nationalist project is coextensive with a theological project that then we have to begin to disentangle. One way of disentangling this is looking at the religious practices of enslaved Africans prior to the mass conversions to Christianity in the early 19th century. So if you begin to think about the religious practices of enslaved Africans, when Frederick Douglass talks about his grandfather writing an indecipherable script in the ground and narrative of a life of Frederick Douglass, he's talking about writing Arabic. Up to almost 30% of enslaved Africans in the U.S. were Muslim. These were literate cultures. And do not think that this Muslim identity died when you had the Baptists and Methodists doing mass Christianizations, mass transformations in the Black Belt. So now we're realizing that we got to redesign the course. One thing that we wanted to do in the January of 2020, when we launched the course again, we're going to have the ability to begin to think quite complexly in a seminary context about how do you begin to host different religious faiths on their own terms within a particular polity. How do you forge the language of religious freedom when individuals are using different concepts, different frameworks, and different ideas to populate that language with different symbols and different messages? How do you begin to negotiate and translate that complex linguistic interplay? And then how do you begin to do that when it is materially based within a particular polity? Now, what comes out of this in January 2020 are no guarantees. The one thing that we know is as long as we continue to talk and share together, as long as we are willing to come around the table and talk with one another, as long as we are able to think in a manner of a wounded thinker that's open to possibilities of change, then maybe we can get this thing around religious freedom right one day in the long future. This is one exercise in that possibility. No guarantees. All of it is really provisional, and we're always ready to revise it in a different manner so that then this thing we call religious liberty doesn't become a static concept, but becomes the very life air that we breathe each and every day.
Thank you. It's a challenging word, but one I think that we're ready for and want to embrace with you. Well, Linda, tonight, talking about seminaries, we're in a liminal moment, you know, on the cusp of the closure of BTSR, and also at the beginning, at a new beginning. And so I wondered if you could speak to what it means to be here tonight, and also maybe some of the legacy of BTSR and what the future looks like it might hold.
It's Holy Saturday, folks, and we are attending with linens and spices to the body of Baptist Theological Seminary at Richmond, and we're waiting for Easter to arrive. And as we think in our moments of sorrow and pain, what might that moment look like? What might resurrection morning, how might it appear? And I ask it in terms of a question. Would it be a resurrection moment for Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and that Holy Sunday to find that the legacy of Baptist Theological Seminary could reside in a conversation, in a structure that would elicit conversation, in a structure that would elicit new information, the production of new knowledge, that would create not only knowledge, but also activism and programs of action. So BTSR, as we are in this Holy Saturday moment, still attending to the linen cloths and the spices and addressing the needs of that body now losing its life. And forgive me for speaking in this kind of metaphorical language. BTSR has had a 30-year wonderful run, and on May 25, we will have our final graduation. And as one who was there when BTSR started in 1991, this is a sorrowful moment in time. But we, as people of faith, do believe that there are things that happen on the other side of that Saturday. Do I have a witness, right? Meaning that there are some things that we are hoping that will come out of those grave cloths that will be positive and growth places, growth points for the fellowship of believers. And might BTSR find itself in a center that could focus on these very things that we're talking about in ways that bring life to all of us? We are thinking of those things. No announcements to make tonight. Corey is working on those things. I am working on those things. We are hoping to see if we cannot roll the life. Yes, in some ways, a corpse, but we know that that corpse did not stay dead, right? And that corpse, Baptist Theological Seminary at Richmond, we are hoping will have a semblance of some kind of resurrection morning where the ministry of 30 years of work is given over to understanding race and understanding what it means to live together in a beloved community. Enough?
That's great. Thank you. Well, you have given us so much, both of you, to think about and to go out from here. As we said, we BJC people want to lead these conversations. So as we leave, I thought it would be nice just to hear a brief word from both of you of any advice you might have to us on how we might help lead these conversations in a productive manner.
Be open, be honest, willing to revise the ways in which you understand, convene courageous conversations that are in the spirit of advancing beloved community and maintain hope for the emergence of our new humanity that comes each and every day with God's grace and the gift of God's presence with us always.
May I just say amen to that?
Yes. Thank you. I was going to have everyone thank you for joining us in conversation. Thank you. And I hope we can take this and start new conversations and really write a new hymn book, as you said. Nice. All right. Nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
A video of the entire conversation is also available on the BJC's YouTube channel. Now, as promised, here's another portion of the program, testimonials from our BJC fellows. You'll hear one of our 2015 BJC fellows, Elisa Aldape, introduce the program, and then nine fellows, including two from this year's class, will share their perspectives.
Good evening. My name is Elisa Aldape. I am a BJC fellow from the 2015 class. And I'd like to tell you tonight a little bit more about the BJC Fellowship. Since 2015, the Baptist Joint Committee has equipped lay and ordained religious and all-religious folk to advocate for religious liberty. Each year, the BJC selects 10 outstanding people to equip them. Yes, thank you. Stop. To equip them to have a deeper historical, theological, and legal understanding of religious liberty. For 5 days, I sat and learned from my fellow fellows and the brilliant staff and other scholars that came to us and taught us about a deeper understanding of what it means to be an advocate for religious liberty. You see, if you grew up as a good Baptist kid, as a good Baptist child, like me, you knew all of the things that Baptists didn't do, right? Smoke, cuss, or chew, or go with people that do. For me, it felt a lot like we were Baptists that didn't do much, right? But after taking Baptist heritage with the wonderful Reverend Dr. Pam Derso, I learned that as Baptists, we came from a long line of doers. I became the biggest Baptist fangirl, and as a freshly ordained, freshly graduated master of the divine, I knew how to talk about the fragile freedoms, right, and why they matter to us as a person, as people of faith. But siblings, it is easy to practice and preach prophetic sermons and to tweet prophetic tweets and to write op-eds. Those can only take us so far. I knew it was important to understand and learn about policies and laws that my fellow church, that affected not only the people in my pew sitting beside me, not only my church members, but also the lives of gay, trans, Muslim, Jewish, Latinx, Sikh neighbors. And so, friends, I encourage you tonight, if you are interested in going deeper in your understanding of religious liberty, check out the BJC Fellowship. If you'd like to know more in your community, I would encourage you to invite one of the many brilliant, outstanding BJC Fellows to your church. And if you don't know who they are, flip that program over, and we have a lovely list of them behind there that you can tweet, I guess, because our handles are on there. You can tweet at us and ask us on there. You can, you know, send us a DM. slide into those DMs. But friends, to paraphrase our brother, John Leland, if we as Baptists hold freedom of conscience as a core belief, as people of faith, then at the very core of advocacy of religious liberty ought to be ecumenical. And so I'm thankful for the Baptist Joint Committee Fellowship, because not only was it just people of my faith, but it was people of other faiths. And we learned together to understand how to deeply advocate for one another. And I'm thankful for that lesson, for the resources and tools it gave me to help youth understand that Baptist was more than just not doing. It helped me give better reason or better explanations to my young adults who will happily tell you how much I love talking about this. It gives us the resources we need to better understand and uplift and empower our people to understand that it's not just for us, it's for all people. And so I would like to invite my fellows up here to talk about their experience, about what it means to be a BJC fellow, and how they have used those tools and resources in their work and context.
Good evening. I am Sabrina Dent. I'm a native of Petersburg, Virginia, and I am a 2015 BJC Fellow. For me, being a BJC Fellow means extending the invitation for people of color and marginalized communities to be included in a larger conversation that impacts not only our religious freedom, but our human rights. It's because of the BJC and my introduction to it that I've been able to pursue my passion through my work at the Religious Freedom Center by centering the perspectives of African Americans on this topic.
I'm Courtney Pace, originally from Arlington, Texas, now in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm a 2017 BJC Fellow. As a seminary professor and a community activist, being a BJC Fellow means modeling responsible faith and citizenship, encouraging my students and the faith communities they represent to understand both more fully, and working within my community to protect religious liberty for everyone.
My name is Sophie Hersher, originally from Sacramento, California, now residing here in the district. Being a BJC Fellow to me means building lasting, sustainable interfaith partnerships. As the first Jewish and the first interfaith fellow, happy seventh night of Passover. I am so thrilled and so happy to be a partner with this organization. I will continue to be for as long as I can because I have been able to learn and grow so much in my own interfaith partnership, and I am now able to bring my own community to the table as we work together to protect religious liberty for both communities and all religious communities.
I'm Will Thomas Clapp from Falls Church, Virginia, a 2018 BJC Fellow. The fellowship program provided the opportunity for me to strengthen my connection to my Baptist identity. And in so doing, it made me aware of how deepening our understanding of the relationship between our faith and our government helps us to understand just truly how far-reaching our relationship to God is.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kristen Donnelly. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I am a 2017 BJC Fellow. And for me, being a BJC Fellow is the most patriotic thing that I do. It is to be able to stand alongside these incredible, wise women and men as we go about the imperative work of remembering exactly who we are as a nation and fighting against Christian exceptionalism. As a business owner, it's incredibly important because the idea of any sort of like test for my employees on what they believe, it just makes me grumpy. And I don't want to do that. I've lived in Christian nations and they're annoying. I like this one and I want to keep it that way.
I'm Sarah Amick Alzubi and I'm a 2016 BJC Fellow. Being a BJC Fellow means faithfully supporting the BJC's mission through both my words and actions. This includes being a monthly donor to the BJC. As an active member of Richmond's First Baptist Church and volunteer with local nonprofit and interfaith organizations, I have many opportunities to get to know and befriend people of various backgrounds and faiths. As a Christian married to a Muslim, the need to protect and respect the religious liberties of all people and faiths is personally very important to me.
My name is Chelsea Clark. I am a 2018 BJC Fellow. I'm originally from Walton, Kentucky, which is a speck of a town, but I currently reside here in Washington, D.C. And being a BJC Fellow to me means having the tools and resources to amplify the voices of those who are advocating on behalf of religious liberty. As a person of faith living in Washington, D.C., as a lay leader at First Baptist Church, and as someone who works four blocks north of the White House at a major media company, this carries with it a weight of responsibility to be actively engaged in the national conversation, particularly when it comes to conversations around the First Amendment. Protecting, extending, and defending religious liberty for all, the freedom of speech and of the press, and the right to peacefully assemble, which is basically a weekly, sometimes daily occurrence here in DC. I'm grateful for the education that I received as a BJC fellow, because not only am I able to march and gather and hold protest signs and hand deliver the report from the Capitol. Nope, I said that wrong. BJC report. Yeah, for report. I did say that right. To members of Congress when needed, but I'm also able to have conversations in my sphere of influence. So that's all thanks to the tools that I gained as a BJC fellow.
I'm Taylor Bell. I'm a local pastor from Birmingham, Alabama, and I'll be a 2019 BJC fellow, which for me is about strengthening my own calling to lead the local church in making justice and equity a public reality. For me, living out this calling hinges on my response to the question, how does the church, both responsibly and with integrity, engage the American public? Without integrity, the church forgets its own calling, but without responsibility, the church threatens American democracy. So I applied to be a BJC fellow because I know that they'll guide me towards a responsible and integral answer that is truly just and equitable.
Good evening. I'm Jillian Handkammer. I'm originally from Nacogdoches, Texas. I now live and serve in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. I am part of the new 2019 BJC Fellows class, and I applied and am excited about this program because I want to have practical tools to work for religious liberty in my very rural Mennonite Amish context. The deacons of my church and I often talk about what it means to redefine being a Baptist church, and I am convinced that understanding and advocating for religious liberty is fundamental to that redefinition for us and for our whole community. I'm excited to spend and dedicate time to this program and to put the concept of religious liberty that I learned in seminary to practice in a really practical way that I haven't been able to do before.
Thanks for joining us today and listening to the BJC podcast. Please take a moment to rate us on Apple Podcasts or share the BJC podcast however you listen to it, via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or on our website. And as always, be sure to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter and now Instagram at the same handle, which is @BJCOnTheHill. Visit our YouTube channel and subscribe to see a video of this conversation. For more from BJC, visit our website at bjconline.org.